Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
By next year, more than half of the world's wealth will be controlled by 1% of the population. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, January 19th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and it's great to have you with us. Tomorrow night, President Obama is scheduled to address both houses of Congress and the American people. He'll deliver his sixth State of the Union address. Over the last few weeks, he's put forward a series of new policy proposals. The latest one is tax reform. The president wants a new tax credit for families in which both parents work. He also wants bigger, simpler tax credits for childcare, college, and retirement. The administration wants to pay for that with higher taxes on what it calls the wealthiest. The wealthiest people, with tax hikes on capital gains and inheritance, but also the wealthiest banks. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains.
It's not just taxing the rich banks in order to spend on the poor middle class. It's taxing the debt of the 100 or so richest banks. That's money borrowed by the banks. The administration wants to take 7 cents for every $100 owed, which could add up to $110 billion.
In principle, this is the right direction to go.
Anat Admati, professor of finance and economics at Stanford, says it's not just about raising money. It's about changing a tax code which has it backwards on borrowing.
The more debt they use, the less tax they pay.
That's a problem for banks in particular, because more debt means more leverage, bigger bets with other people's money, the kind that caused the last financial crisis. That's why Obama proposed this tax 5 years ago.
We want our money back, and we're going to get it. And that's why I'm proposing a financial crisis responsibility fee.
This fee was dead on arrival in 2010. But that doesn't dissuade Admati.
Well, we have a lot of good ideas that somehow die, so to bring them back is a good thing.
The big banks do not think it's such a good thing. One of their powerful lobbying organizations, the ABA, sent out a statement saying, quote, "It is completely at odds to want more jobs while hurting banks that finance the business growth necessary to create them." So what are this proposal's chances?
I think it has no shot.
Joel Slemrod is an economist who directs the Office of Tax Policy Research at the University of Michigan.
We're that many years farther from the financial crisis, and I think the urgency of this kind of policy is lower.
With both houses of Congress controlled by the Republicans, Slemrod says we can expect a bill that includes tax increases, especially on the big banks, to share the fate of its predecessor, death. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
I threw out a stat at the top of the show that 1% of the world's population is going to control more than half of the world's wealth by next year. That comes from the charity Oxfam. It released a report with some staggering new numbers on inequality today. Another stat is that the 80 richest people in the world will be worth the same amount as the bottom 3.5 billion. There's a lot of debate over whether inequality is a bad thing, and we're not going to settle that fight today. But say we did want to level the playing field just a little bit. What would it take? Marketplace's Noel King reports.
Oxfam thinks inequality is a bad thing, not just for non-billionaires, but for the economy. Oxfam's Max Lawson spoke to the BBC this morning.
If you have all of this wealth concentrated in just a few hands, then not in the hands of consumers. So you're not seeing real wages rising. You're not seeing people going out to the shops.
But solutions aren't easy to find. Take President Obama's push to get Congress to raise taxes for the richest Americans and big financial firms. Diane Lim is the VP for Economic Research at the Nonprofit Committee for Economic Development. She says as a solution, that's a non-starter.
You know, it's going to go nowhere because politically that approach, let's just tax the rich more so that we can give more to the lower and middle classes, you know, that gets labeled redistribution, that turns into a partisan issue, it's dead on arrival with the Republicans in Congress.
Lim says we need to start with the causes of inequality. A big one, at least here at home, many Americans are stuck in low-paid jobs. Melissa Carney, who teaches economics at the University of Maryland, says more Americans need training for jobs in science and technology, but she says not everyone is going to be an engineer or a doctor.
And we have to be committed to making sure that individuals who are going to be working in retail sectors and service sectors are able to make ends meet. And that is going to require redistribution.
To redistribute or not to redistribute is another debate we're not going to settle today. But either way, thanks to the gains made by developing countries, global inequality is, by some measures, shrinking. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed today for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but markets were open in Europe and Asia. Details when we do the numbers. The North American International Auto Show winds down this week in Detroit, and you can get a glimpse of what the car of the future could look like. It involves data, and car companies plan to use data to learn more about how we drive and where we drive. Eventually, that'll lead to safer cars and probably more advertising. It will also make cars more vulnerable to hacking. Matt Baum tells us more.
Imagine in a few years you're driving your brand new Ford Mustang up a winding mountain road. Whenever it's time to shift gears, the car prompts you with a little buzz from the gear shift knob. The car can predict the optimal moment to shift because it's been watching how you accelerate and throttle, and it's built a profile of your personal driving style. By the end of the decade, our cars could be offering us all kinds of helpful personalized advice. For example, software giant SAP is working on a navigation system that helps you organize your errands. Gil Perez is SAP's general manager of connected vehicles.
When you've got your low fuel light goes on, you know, the system really directs you to the optimal fueling station around you, taking into your consideration your route, your preferences, etc.
Once the car's brought you to a gas station, it might recommend some refreshments based on how long it knows you've been driving. Meanwhile, software company Axway is working on tools that would let you bring your radio presets with you from car to car, as well as more personal data. Here's Axway's VP of Innovation, Mark O'Neill.
We have talked to some companies about the possibility that cars would store some of your health data as well in the event that you're in an accident.
But that level of innovation is still a few years off. The most advanced tricks on the market today are things like an app that shows your electric car's battery level or a navigation system that reads addresses from your phone's contact list. So what's holding up the car of the future? In part, security concerns.
So anything that can be controlled by software can be subverted.
Mark Corman is a security researcher with a good guy hacker collective called IamTheCavalry.org. His colleagues Chris Valasek and Charlie Miller were the first to figure out how to trick a car into giving up control.
Because software controls things like steering and parking assist and the braking, they were able to shut off the brakes, jerk the steering wheel out of the hands of the driver.
All Valasek needed was a $100 piece of equipment hardwired into the vehicle.
We could control all these mechanisms of the vehicle just by sending computer messages on the car's network.
Some cars already store contact info, and soon they'll have your credit card data too. So an attack might take the form of data theft rather than mayhem, says security researcher Allison Chaikin.
If you're storing data that's worth money in your car, you're actually placing not only the data at risk, but your safety.
Car manufacturers are well aware of these vulnerabilities and are doing their best to prevent or patch them. For example, Ford's software platform called OpenXC is open source, which means anyone can take a look at how it works. Dr. K. Venkatesh Prasad, a senior technical leader at Ford, says that open source can be safer than closed source.
Because there might be just one person on the planet who knows how to change that code, no one else does, and if that one person is not available or is out on a hike, you don't have a way to fix it.
Mark O'Neill at Axway says the company can use a technique called GeoIP lookup to validate the source of the signals hitting the car.
It's something where you, first of all, want to make sure that the person interacting with the car is coming from where you expect they're coming from.
We've had smartphones for years, and now our cars are finally catching up. So if you're comfortable with the security measures on your phone, you probably won't mind having a connected car. But if the idea of a hackable computer on wheels makes you uncomfortable, there's still an alternative. You can always invest in a bike. For now, a good U-lock and some skewers are the only security you need. In Seattle, I'm Matt Baum for Marketplace.
Here in Washington, momentum may be building to repeal part of the Affordable Care Act, a 2.3% sales tax on medical devices, everything from surgical gloves to artificial joints. That tax hike was designed to help cover some of Obamacare's costs, but the medical device industry hasn't been happy about footing the bill, and it's hired an army of lobbyists. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports.
When it comes to the medical device tax, Steve Ferguson likes to talk straight.
It's a job killer.
Yep, a job killer. So bad, he says, that it's chasing away a good industry.
I think they'll just continue to move overseas and manufacture over there.
Ferguson chairs the board of Cook Medical. His industry estimates the tax will cost 40,000 jobs. And since 2008, manufacturers have spent more than $200 million to make sure their word is heard. The Congressional Research Services counters the tax will only have a modest impact on companies. Paul Vandewater is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He worries repealing the tax may lead to a feeding frenzy.
Representatives of the hospital industry have already indicated that if relief is provided to the medical device industry, they're going to be next in line.
Here's what gets lost sometimes in the health reform debate. Shaking things up usually means someone loses money, says Dr. Kavita Patel with the Brookings Institution. But the people who stand to lose have the means to fight.
There are so many vested interests that you can't really change something without creating a ripple effect. And in other words, taking money from one place to give it to another is just a heavily controversial topic.
Patel points out a lot of wealth is being created by Obamacare, for example, health exchanges, new insurance products. And that's why she believes, regardless of the GOP majorities in Congress, the ACA isn't going away anytime soon. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, people would find that a certain habit was associated with a period of productivity or a great insight, and then they would relentlessly stick to that one ritual.
How do you get those creative juices flowing? First, let's do the numbers. The stock and bond markets were closed in the U.S. because of the holiday, but Chinese markets bled red as regulators there clamped down on margin trading. The Shanghai Composite barreled down 7.7%. China releases its GDP numbers tomorrow, and economists are speculating that the country's growth rate could fall to 7.3%, its slowest in 20 years. Investors reacted to that news by selling commodities. Copper, aluminum, zinc, and nickel all fell on the London Metals Exchange as speculators gambled slowing growth in China will mean less demand for those materials. Gold fell also, but lead rose on news of a key mine closure. Things looked healthier in Europe. In Frankfurt, the DAX rose nearly 0.75%. In London, the FT 100 popped up 0.5%. And in Paris, the CAC 40 climbed 0.33%. In Japan, Tokyo's Nikkei rose nearly 0.9%. Oil prices gave back some of the slight gains they made at the end of last week. Brent crude slid to just over $49 a barrel. Oil is now down 40% from November. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Barack Obama will stand before a joint session of Congress to deliver his State of the Union address. The National Association of Home Builders will look at the demand for new homes in January. And if you're in need of a pick-me-up after the long weekend, take a break, grab some coffee. Ooh, and that donut. Why not? It's National Coffee Break Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. A question on the mind of every online shopper is, how quickly can I get what I've ordered? How long will it take for a product to make its way from some warehouse to my doorstep? Online retailers know how important it is to be fast, so they spend a lot of time on distribution, on what are called shipping and fulfillment services, and they've made great strides. Customers can count on getting packages speedily, even in remote places like rural Alaska, as Zachariah Hughes of Alaska Public Media reports.
Betsy Brennan unpacks a box at the radio station where she works in Nome, Alaska, 3 blocks from the Bering Sea and separated by hundreds of miles from the state's highway system.
We're good for a couple weeks, maybe.
Inside are a few dozen rolls of toilet paper from online retail giant Amazon.com. Brennan has an auto order set up through the company's Prime service so that every couple of weeks, office essentials like paper towels, printer cartridges, and coffee arrive. Because of the free shipping that comes with the annual $99 subscription fee, Amazon Prime's popularity is exploding in rural Alaska. Brennan set up her household account 2 years ago for things you might take for granted if you live in a place with road access.
Even really heavy items like flour, all kinds of food items that we pay a lot more locally, or very similar, but it comes many times right to your doorstep.
Amazon isn't a shipper. Instead, it's just taking advantage of where the postal service and freight companies already go. And now, it's bringing e-commerce even further into markets where it hasn't had much of a foothold. Jeff Erickson lives in Unalakleet, a town of about 700 that's another hour-long flight from Nome. He's been using Amazon more and more over the last 6 years and recently bought a mattress.
3 days later, I hear somebody struggling up my stairs and it's the UPS boy who's dropping it off. Got my knife out, made a tiny split in it, and all of a sudden I had an instant California king-size mattress that exploded in my face.
Erickson estimates he gets about 30% more buying power now without shipping fees. Both he and Brennan think that if Amazon knew what a steal they were getting, they'd put an end to Prime. But RJ Hadavi, the senior e-commerce analyst with Morningstar, disagrees.
Amazon is incredibly data savvy. I'm absolutely sure that they see, you know, higher penetration rates in certain rural markets. Yeah, and I think that part of that's by design.
Hadavi thinks the company is trying to drum up customer loyalty and has decided it's worth it to lose money right now if it means recruiting long-term users. I'm Zachariah Hughes for Marketplace.
Morocco is a country famous for its crafts, rugs, lamps, jewelry, and mosaics, and there's a growing market for those kinds of handmade products outside Morocco. But if you're an artist with limited access to the internet or you don't know English, an e-commerce site like Etsy doesn't really work. Alex Schmidt reports from Morocco on a homegrown project that tries to connect artists directly to buyers.
In the small village of Eight Hamza in the Atlas Mountains of Morocco, electricity is scarce, but 3G internet is usually available. Weaver Kenza Ularda is demonstrating her process for displaying one of her co-op's rugs online.
I go to the tape.
Ularda heads the co-op, which has 20 members, all women. The steps she takes on the website are clearly indicated with large numbers and simple photos, but there are no letters.
It's easy for all the artisans because we can work by pictures.
Morocco is famous for its artisan crafts, rugs, lamps, jewelry, mosaic. Tourists often return home with suitcases full of spoils. A new founder, Dan Driscoll, and some colleagues were working as Peace Corps volunteers a few years ago in Morocco. They noticed that many artisans were living in poverty. Some make only around $100 a month.
No one wants to become an artisan because there's no money in it. You can only sacrifice so much to really preserve your cultural heritage. You know, so if nothing changes, and the artisan sector just won't exist anymore in 20 years.
The Anew site addresses the technological hurdle of posting to the web, but that's just the first step in a much bigger process of becoming actual business owners. In essence, to use Anew, artisans are taking on the additional roles of the vilified middleman, and that's no easy task. Marcia Dixon is a professor of fashion and apparel studies at the University of Delaware.
Middlemen in general do perform a service. You know, a lot of times an artisan might have trouble pricing to make sure that all their input costs are covered. They also, middlemen have often acted in the role of what we call culture brokers, helping the artisans understand what customers in the U.S. or Europe want.
But Dan Driscoll says it's imperative that artisans take on these roles. And Anew is helping them do it. The site lets artisans get feedback on their designs. And there's now a whole infrastructure of artisan trainers and workshops on how to set prices.
If we're really focused on trying to, you know, ensure that artisans are empowered to lift themselves out of poverty, they have to take full control over their business. How do you do your marketing? How do you take pictures of your product? How do you tell your own story? And if you can get artisans to do that, they can get the full market value of their products.
Right now, 400 Moroccan artisans are represented on ANU. The site's managers are planning to spread the system throughout the country and perhaps expand internationally. Driscoll says artisans from as far away as Kenya, India, and Brazil are clamoring to use the system. In 8 Hamza, I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
There are just 24 hours in a day, but certain people, at least it seems like certain people, are able to do way more with their time than the rest of us. Some of us barely manage to do the laundry, while others write plays, compose operas, and paint landscapes. Author Mason Curry writes about how 161 painters, composers, novelists, and musicians manage their hours in a book called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. And Mason, it's good to have you with us.
Hi there.
I want to start with the distinction that you make, and that's between rituals and routines. Maybe you can help me out with the difference there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually started with this project looking at people's daily routines, at how they organize their day in order to be creative and productive. And along the way, you find that a lot of these people had interesting little idiosyncratic habits or rituals. I think for me, the rituals are the smaller pieces of the routine, and the routine is kind of the framework for making time to do their work.
How many of these folks fell into these rituals? Were they things that they really thought through, or they just started doing?
No, I think they mostly fell into them. I think, you know, people would find that a certain habit was associated with a period of productivity or a great insight, and then they would often kind of relentlessly stick to that one ritual in a sort of superstitious fashion, believing that it was, somehow enabled their creativity.
Walk me through the process of you writing this book. Did you adopt a routine yourself? Did you go through the same thing every day as you were putting this book together?
I did, yeah. I've always been a real morning person. I find that I get my best work done early in the morning. But when I was compiling the book, I was also working a full-time job, and I figured that the only way I could do both things was to get up early every morning. So I started getting up at 5:30 every weekday morning, and I would work on the book for 2 hours and then have breakfast with my wife and go off to my day job. And then often in the evenings, I would go to the library to do some research.
So you were working a job as you wrote this. Was that the case as you looked at these other routines that, you know, often people have to sort of balance, you know, either their personal lives with their professional lives? They have to do several things. And so a routine is a way of compartmentalizing things?
Yeah, exactly. I think almost every figure in the book has some kind of obstacle, and they are using their routine as a kind of tool to get around whatever the obstacles in their life are. In some cases, that's a day job. In other cases, it's family commitments or personal preferences, people who could only work late at night or early in the morning or whatever. The routine was kind of a way of organizing things for maximum effect.
Some of these are so specific, to my mind at least, it's not just what works, but it's this sort of imposed rigidity that, you know, I think of the very famous schedule that Ben Franklin tried to impose upon himself, that, you know, there were allotted hours for certain things. Does that always work, or does that sort of fall to the wayside?
I think it often falls by the wayside. I think the reason people are so strict is because it is a struggle for them to stick to it, and they have to be strict with themselves. There's a great interview with David Foster Wallace where he talks about how he has a strict routine during the times that he's not getting writing done, that when he doesn't have writing done, he sets this really strict framework, and it's, you know, do this for 20 minutes and do that for an hour. But that when he does kind of hit a good writing period, then all the routines go out the window and he's able to just work and he doesn't have to think about that stuff.
Is there someone in this book whose routine seemed to have it down, who seemed to be incredibly prolific, maybe the more prolific compared to the rest?
The British novelist Anthony Trollope was particularly impressive. He worked at the post office for more than 30 years and also at the same time was a very successful and prolific writer. He would get up at, I think it was 5 a.m. every morning and write for 2.5 hours. And he would keep a pocket watch on the table and would write 250 words per 15 minutes for that whole period. And then if he finished a book during that 2.5 hours, he would immediately put that page away and get out a fresh sheet of paper and start the next book.
If you had to give some advice to a public radio reporter about a ritual that might work, what would you say?
You know, I would say take a walk every day. I was really struck by how many great writers and artists and composers took a walk alone with a piece of paper in your pocket to take down notes. Seems to be incredibly valuable for so many people throughout history that I think probably we could all benefit from that.
Mason Curry is the author of Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. Thank you, Mason.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, a few weeks ago, a couple of inches of snow fell here in Washington, and our new mayor took some heat, as mayors often do, for how well or how badly the city cleared the streets. Well, an AP story caught my attention this morning. A number of big cities now have smartphone apps you can use to track snow plows in real time, using GPS data. Chicago has an app, so does New York and Seattle. According to the article, it's a way to show skeptics that plow drivers are working hard and not just clearing the streets of the wealthy and well-connected. Although someone pointed out the data can be misleading, a woman in Chicago said the app indicated a snow plow had gone down her street. Indeed it had, but the plow wasn't plowing. It had its blade up. And that's Marketplace for Monday. Markets were closed today in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm David Gura. Kai Rizdahl will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.